recording. Yeah. So, great, thank you. Okay, so did you clean up the highlights and all that?
No, this is, I don't know where I got this.
Is this something from what you sent out?
I did send it out, but I can't tell you if I got it from the documents that you sent me, or it has to be. I can't imagine that I found it elsewhere, but I can't swear to it.
Okay, so let me resend it to you. I'd rather use the one that has the highlights, because the highlights are kind of important. So let me see here.
The recording has started.
All right, so forward back to Woody. I just want to confirm, I actually did send you the one with the highlights. Yes, I did.
Sure you did.
So?
Yes, got the highlights too.
All right, so there we go. I just sent them to you, so... We'll wait for those ones and zeros to chase across the continent and arrive into your computer so that they can assemble into something that becomes, you know, cognitively legible and understandable so that we can comprehend the messages behind all. There we go. That's how I just kill time, just keep rambling. So there's a big difference between this and just a black and white, because now we can see some things that really do that are very critical in some of the points. Almost everything that Jefferson says in this document is important. And I mean, the overall document, the way he framed this and, you know, how he kind of set the stage as this is the end of the world.
G.R., sorry to interrupt. Would you mind giving us a brief overview, high-level chronology between Kentucky and Virginia?
Okay, so earlier in the summer, the federal government passed the Alien and Sedition Acts. There were a total of four acts. And what happened was Jefferson and Madison go, you know, they were already dumbfounded that they were able to form this atrocity, the National Bank. And it seemed like Hamilton was just getting away with doing and executing things that were just absolutely troublesome. And so finally, when Jefferson ended up losing, because if you remember, the election between Jefferson and Adams in the previous, you know, that got Adams into the presidency, it was a tie. And Jefferson stepped aside and said, I'll just accept that you won, even though everything was pointing to it was a tie and they needed to do a recount. Jefferson was gracious in letting Adams kind of take, you know, the presidency, because it wasn't that important to Jefferson. That changed after Adams became, you know, this zealot of, you know, pushing his agenda instead of supporting the Constitution. And the Alien Sedition Acts were a part of that agenda, because they actually created legislation and laws that made it illegal to speak ill of your political opponents. And they also went after the states being able to bring people in that seemed favorable towards freedom and liberty, where, you know, they said, you know, and that's why the Aliens and Sedition Acts, he's going to go through each of these acts, and he's going to give you the titles in this document, because he's going to actually audit the Constitution, then he's going to audit these laws against the Constitution and how they violate it. That's why this one document is kind of like Jefferson conducts a constitutional compliance process, which is what the committees do that we're asking for to be established in every county. Every county committee needs to actually do a basic audit on the Constitution. But before that, we actually have to definitize the Constitution. So I'm helping lay out what they did and how this relates to what we have to do. And so as we dive into this, this is where Jefferson conducts this audit, and then he makes these conclusions that we as states need to unite on these principles that he establishes in the very front of this, that it is not an unlimited government and that they're violating the Constitution, and it is our job to actually step in. And he may use nullification in this one. I know he does in the second one. But what he's talking about is using the power of the parties to force the federal government into nullifying. He's not basically saying we're just going to ignore these and not enforce these as we understand nullification today. So anyway, does that help? Does that give you good background?
Yeah, that's excellent. Were they two separate congressional legislative things, or were they both of those together? Alien and Sedition.
So the Alien and Sedition Acts, there were four. They were all independent acts that they all passed and signed. And so Jefferson just kind of, you know, grabs all four of them and creates a kind of a glumfry or amalgamation of tyranny. And he basically starts attacking each of them as we get into the further resolutions. It's probably about resolution three or four. But what's important is how he kind of goes through this. And so let me kind of, okay, now I've got it full screen so I can read it. Can everybody read it?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for speaking up, Pat. Hands up, or anybody not read it, speak up. Okay, so I'm okay with everybody taking turns because I think the reader actually gets a little bit more out of it when you read. And so who would like to read first? Well, Woody, I see you at the left. Well, so we can kind of Woody, then Jerry, then Pat. So if we want to start with that, go ahead and let's, because what we're going to do is we're not going to read this whole thing and then try to dissect it. What we'll do is we kind of want to take each statement at a time. So go ahead and just read the very first clause, which takes us that it's that yellow or the blue part that takes us to the semicolon. Go ahead and let's just read that one statement.
Resolved that the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government.
So he's basically laying this down that we've not submitted ourselves to a government that thinks they can do anything and everything. Mm-hmm. Okay, keep going.
But that by a compact under the style and title of a Constitution for the United States and of amendments thereto, they constituted a general government for special purposes, delegated to that government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of right to their own self-government.
Okay, right there. So he also starts off with, he identifies what this thing is that has empowered this government, and it's a compact. If nobody understands that, he is literally laying this out, that this is it's something that is a fundamental vehicle for empowering a body to do something for you, whether it be a power of attorney, a limited power of attorney, a general power of attorney. It is a compact. It is an agreement between parties. And in this particular case, it is a compact because a compact has multiple parties. If it's just a contract, that's between two parties. A treaty can also be a large group of parties to it. And so he's referring this to a compact. And in this particular case, is going to create something. But he then lays it out there that this compact, under the style and title of the Constitution and the amendments thereto, and how they've basically created this general government for special purposes and then delegated to that government definite powers, reserving to the state itself. So, I mean, I'm just kind of re-repeating this, but hopefully this, you know, he's laying this out. This is not an unlimited government. And now, hey, this is definitely a limited and defined government by these delegated powers. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now he moves on and says,
and that whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. That to this compact, each state acceded as a state and is an integral part, its co-states forming, as to itself, the other party.
Okay. So right here, he's basically saying that whenever this government that was created by this Constitution does things that it has no authority to do, then they are to be void and of no force, and that this compact, which was agreed to, the acceded, agreed as a state and as an integral part, all of the co-states. In other words, if you really look at this compact, the compact wasn't an agreement between the state and the federal government. So when states came into the union, they came into the union after the original 13. Many of them came in under the impression that they were submitting themselves to the federal government. That is not the case. They were actually adjoining to the parties that were already in this union. The federal government is just an ancillary creature that serves the parties. And this has completely been lost. And so he's kind of pointing out that the co-states forming as to itself the other party, which is the federal government. Keep going.
That the government created by this compact was not made the exclusive or final judge of the extent of the powers delegated to itself.
So he's based. Go ahead. If you, is this making sense for you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
since,
go ahead.
Since that would have made its discretion and not the Constitution the measure of its power, but that, as in all other cases of a compact among powers having no common judge, each party has an equal right to judge for itself, as well infractions as of the mode and measure of redress.
Okay, so those last four and a half lines or what have you, he's laid it out that this creature was created by these states acceding or agreeing to form this compact, forming this alliance that they're going to basically surrender money for this thing to serve them in very specific ways. And so this is one of the reasons why the ratification debates were very, very explicit in what this creature was supposed to do and how they were going to fund it and all of these things which were agreed upon. And then he goes into this point that when it comes down to those things that are not within that compact, it leaves it to the states to be the judges. Because again, and I've said this, but I'll include it now. When we look at Article 3 and we look at the jurisdiction of the court only has jurisdiction over those things arising under this compact. When it comes to the states and what the government and how this federal government interfaces with the states. Now, it has jurisdiction in, you know, international law that doesn't involve the states because that's something that's been delegated. But when it comes to anything that arises under the Constitution, they have jurisdiction. If it is not within the Constitution, such as environment, energy, labor, you know, health care, all of these things, then it is not within their jurisdiction and they have no ability to even hear a case in the court. So, okay, so that kind of cleans up the very first. So here he lays down this argument that we have, when we created, we the states have created this government, and it's a creature that serves us, and it only has these powers. If I could put that into a very short summation of what he just said. So the next paragraph, go ahead.
I'm taken by how almost strident he is in his language. He doesn't hold any punches.
Oh, no. Right. So One of the things that most people loved about Jefferson, and they don't realize that this was the early, young, vim, you know, Jefferson, who had the attitude that the Tree of Liberty needed to be refreshed by the spilling of blood every 20 years. He said that well before the Constitution. He said those things in his younger years. When you look after the Constitution, he actually really tamed his language. And so when he actually started really speaking strongly again, it was in these capacities about holding the government accountable. In other words, he wasn't calling for a revolution. And when you look at what he says, these are very strong words. And this is one of the reasons why when these resolutions went out, many of the states came back with insinuations that, you know, were basically saying, we think you're borderline treasonous. I've never read what they actually said. I would love to see them. I've just never had the access to the documents because I've never seen anybody publish them. But bottom line, you know, his response in 1799 that we'll get to next, or actually it's the third document we'll go into. He actually laments of some of the things that they responded in their insinuations. But go ahead and scroll down so we get the two up there. Thank you. Okay, Jerry, you want to read this?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Resolves that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever.
Okay, so if you can hold right there. So I should have actually maybe used blue or something, but that right there was basically an audit. He identified what criminal laws the federal government had jurisdiction over. So then he kind of says that. Go ahead and read the next one.
And it being true as a general principle in one of the amendments to the Constitution, having also declared that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, not prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Okay, so basically he's saying, so these are the criminal jurisdictions you have, and so those things that are not delegated to you by the 10th Amendment, because that's what he basically just read, he says, then that means that those criminal jurisdictions are not delegated to you, they're reserved to the states. And go ahead and read the next part now.
Therefore, the Act of Congress passed on the 14th day of July, 1798, and entitled...
Entitled. That's how they spelled it back then, entitled.
Oh, my. Okay. An act in addition to the act entitled, an act for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States, as also the act passed by them on the day of June 1798, entitled an act to punish frauds committed on the Bank of the United States and all other acts which assume to create, define, or punish crimes other than those so enumerated in the Constitution are altogether void and of no force, and that the power to create, define, and punish such other crimes is reserved and of right that pertains solely and exclusively to the respective states, each within its own territory.
Excellent. So thank you. So basically, then the last part, he actually audits how these very specific acts, and he gives you the short titles, kind of, because actually down below, he'll really read the whole title. But, you know, he basically lays out that, one, you've created crimes that you have no jurisdiction. They're not in the Constitution. So those things must be left to the states to do. And more importantly, that these crimes, because you have no jurisdiction, have no force. They need to be voided, and that they should not be applied to the states. That these are, you know, those types of things are reserved to the states, respectively, and the states' territories and so forth. Okay, so the next paragraph is where he actually starts diving into each of the individual acts, and he's going to identify how each act violates the Constitution. And so for principle, I think it's really important that everybody read these. I think we can kind of skim over, but I want you to understand that as we look at the next four, I think, because that's how far it goes, and I want to make sure I'm on my other computer, and I am. So go ahead, Woody, and we can pass over. I just want you to know that what he's doing in these petitions, or I should say these resolutions in three and four, and five are kind of, well, actually, let's read five, because five brings a highlight to something that's, I think, is really critical that we understand in the Constitution, that if you don't read this, you won't understand what ended up happening over the importation of persons and migration, or I should say immigration of persons. So go ahead. Pat, can you read that?
Sure. Resolve that in addition to the general principle, as well as the express declaration that powers not delegate are reserved, another and more special provisions inserted in the Constitution from abundant caution was declared that the migration of importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808.
Okay, so if you can pause right there. Thank you. What he just basically said is what that quote is out of is Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. That citation he just gave you is right there in the Constitution that prohibits the federal government from being involved in any way of stopping and keeping the states from being able to import people directly. This was something that was granted to the states that really spoke about slavery, but because they did this, they didn't just qualify it to only slavery. The states had full unabridged power for 20 years to have full control of the importation of people. In other words, immigration is a one-by-one. People come here, they apply, I'd like to be a citizen. Well, the states actually just had open arms and said, come on in, you know, and just they went out, and actually some of the southern states brought in basically shiploads of slaves instead of allowing one person. They was just like a commodity. They were property. And so they didn't treat that as immigration. They just looked at that as the importation of property or people. And so even though they identify it as people and they wanted to be very clear that they weren't being insensitive, the fact is that they had this unabridged authority in 1808. Now, I want to add this because I want everybody to understand that this didn't mean in 1809 the federal government assumed the authority of the importation of persons. No. This importation of persons ends. What happens is now the federal government basically takes over, and their requirement is actually, if you look at it, is not actually allowing any importation. If you read Article 1, Section 8, the federal government has the role and responsibility and the power to create a uniform rule of naturalization. And when we read the Naturalization Act, you will notice that in 1795, it identifies that the citizenship is initially controlled. So when people migrate, because they knew that people weren't getting off the ship in D.C., they knew that people were getting off the ships in the Carolinas, Virginia, Maryland, and all the way up to Massachusetts and Maine. As when Maine became a state. So in other words, they knew that the people would enter into the United States via the ports in the states. D.C. was not a port or a port of entry for all persons coming into the U.S. They didn't have the capability of doing that. So they realized that the states would be the recipients. And if this person settled in that state or decided to migrate to an interior state or what have you, that person would then have to, and this is why they created the law, that person would then have to register with that state by the county or what have you, going to the court and say, I want to be a citizen of the state. Now, I went down a rat hole, but I want you to understand that the states had the responsibility, based on that law and how they defined it, they had the responsibility of determining whether this person could become a citizen of the state or not. If the state, if you read that 1795 Act, if the state says, no, we won't let you be a citizen of the United States, and that person takes offense, they get up and they go to another state and they find that state is more receptive, and maybe they change their tune or they behave differently or what have you, and they say, I'd like to become a citizen. That state that rejected them has to actually send a notice to D.C. to say, this person came to our state and we denied them citizenship. Because what happens is, if the other state actually says, yeah, we're going to allow you to become a citizen, and so that state sends the notice to D.C. and says, we want to put this person in the process of the Naturalization Act, so they're going to learn and do what they need to do to become a citizen, because they have to wait so many years to become a citizen. Well, when D.C. looks at this, when the federal government looks at this, they go, hold on, sorry, that guy can't become a citizen because this state denied him the ability to become a citizen. And that's why when you read in that 1795 Act that if that person is going to become a citizen, that other state's legislature has to basically recall that denial of citizenship. They have to formally say, we will allow that person to become a citizen in that state. So that's how powerful this whole migration and this concept of, you know, this importation of people, such as refugees or just opening our borders, that is not permitted in this society that was created of how people were to come here. They were to come here and they were basically to file and petition, but over time, they changed to make sure that people just couldn't come. They actually had to get permission first, because as we started getting overran by Irish and what have you, they said, this is kind of crazy. So they said, you have to actually apply before you land here first. And so they changed those laws to do that. But now they've done away with that, and that actually gets into another rat hole. But so I'll yield at this point. But hopefully this makes sense why this one little clause is so important. Because what these Alien Sedition Acts were doing was just saying, you can't do this anymore. And Thomas Jefferson said, hold on here. Have you forgotten that we actually have this unabridged authority of the importation of people? And so go ahead, Pat, and read the last part of this.
That this Commonwealth does admit the migration of alien friends described as the subject of the said act concerning equivalent thereto, or it would be nugatory, that to remove them when migrated is equivalent to a prohibition of their migration and is therefore contrary to the said provision of the Constitution and void.
Yeah, so basically saying you can't do this. We've already forbidden you from being able to do this, and now you're saying you can do it. So anyway, would he do me a favor? And you know how you have this little, actually, this looks like, are you on Apple?
No, Microsoft.
Okay, Microsoft. If you double click on the space between the pages, it should actually take that gap, the headers and all of that away.
Yeah, it's not.
Interesting. Yeah, no. Actually, get canceled. And then just there's this space, that little blank space between the pages. Get your cursor right there on that space and double click on it.
Yeah.
Right there. Yeah, I see your spouse. Yeah, double click right there.
That's what keeps coming up. How about layout here? Is that what you want?
Well, so no, what's happened is you're in the footer. So go ahead and hit cancel and get out of the footer. I'm sorry, folks. To get out of the footer, to double into the page. Boom, boom. Double click up on the six or the green. Yeah, just there you go. Now you're out. Now double click. See, you got that? There you go. There, okay. See? That's how you hide all of the header and footer information so you can read. There we go.
Okay.
There was a reason why I wanted to do that, because it kind of gives us the full view. Okay, so that leaves it to me. So actually, Sean, do you want to read this? Since I've read it a few times.
Sure, no problem. Where are we?
Resolve six,
the green part.
All right. That the imprisonment of a person under the protection of these laws, the laws of this Commonwealth, on his failure to obey the simple order of the president to depart out of the United States, as is undertaken by said act initialed an act concerning aliens, is contrary to the Constitution, one amendment to which has provided that no person shall be deprived of liberty without due process of law, and that another having provided that in all criminal prosecution the accused shall enjoy the right to public trial by an impartial jury, to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. The same act undertaken to authorize the president to remove a person out of the United States who is under the protection of the law on his own suspicion, without accusation, without jury, without public trial, without confrontation of the witnesses against him, without hearing witnesses in his favor, without defense, without counsel, is contrary to the provision also of the Constitution. Is therefore not law, but utterly void and of no force, that transferring the power of judging any person who is under the protection of the laws from the courts to the President of the United States, as is undertaken by the same act concerning aliens, is against the article of the Constitution, which provides that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in the courts, the judges of which shall hold their offices during good behavior, and that the said act is void for that reason also. And it is further to be noted, excuse me, that this transfer of judiciary power is to that magistrate of the general government who already possesses all the executive and a negative on all legislative powers.
Okay, so here's an interesting thing. This is where Thomas Jefferson makes this assertion that the Bill of Rights is applied to those people who have migrated here. Now, this is highlighted green, but the point is that when we read the 14th Amendment, everything changed, because the 14th Amendment only applies these privileges and immunities that he kind of listed out of the Bill of Rights, this right to, you know, due process and all of these other things, that based on the 14th Amendment in Section 1, only applies to U.S. citizens. So he's basically painting this picture that you can't be involved at all, whether these are citizens or non-citizens at this point in time. But this paradigm, or I should say, this paradigm is no longer accurate post the 14th Amendment. That's the whole point of me highlighting this. Does this make sense, folks?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. All right, so now going into 7, because 7 kind of sets up the stage for the 8th paragraph. And so, Mike, are you on a phone or did you dial in?
I dialed in.
Okay, so you're on a phone. I'm sorry, I gave you two options for a phone. You didn't log in. You're on a phone, so you can't see the screen. And Rich, you probably can't see the screen. And I'm guessing. Go ahead.
I'm kind of in a room. I'm kind of in a remote area. So.
Okay.
And I'm on the phone.
Yeah. Okay. And so I'm guessing that the next person over from 917, you're on the phone as well as Kent is on the phone. Because what we're trying to do is, if you can see the screen, we wanted to kind of read along. So I guess this whips around so I can either read, or Woody, do you want to read?
Why don't you go, and then I'll go after you.
Okay, that's fine. So 7, resolved that the Constitution applied by the general government as in evidenced by a sundry of their proceedings to those parts of the Constitution of the United States which delegate to Congress a power, quote, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imports, and excises, to pay the debts, and to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, close quote, and, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof, close quote, goes to the destruction of all limits prescribed to the power by the Constitution, that words meant by the instrument to be subsidiary only to the execution of limited powers ought not to be so construed as themselves to give unlimited powers, nor a part to be so taken as to destroy the whole residual of the instrument, that the proceedings of the general government under color of these articles will be a fit and necessary subject of revisal and correction, and at a time greater tranquility, while those specified in the preceding resolutions call for immediate redress. In other words, he's basically, if you really look at this, he's in this language, he is using a petition, and he's petitioning to the other states to say, look, what they're doing is ultimately going to wipe out the Constitution itself. And so we have to basically stand in because they don't have these unlimited powers because they're using the necessary and proper clause as their justification. And that's not how it was intended. And so we need to actually step in. And so this is why he ends this with a call for immediate redress. So he's now set this stage to say, hey, now what are we going to do? And so in paragraph 8, is how he lays this out. This is a very long paragraph, and actually there's a part where it's almost, you know, takes up the body of the paragraph where it is one sentence. So there's these semicolons that we want to kind of focus on, but more importantly, he lays out in the very beginning what the states need to do. So let's go ahead and just define that, and then I'll explain what he's calling for. So go ahead.
Quick question, you don't need to, well, the first one is probably either you know it or you don't. Was this a close vote in the Kentucky legislature, or was it like a whitewash?
So it was a unanimous vote. I'm sorry, it was a unanimous vote.
So the follow-up is even more puzzling to me. We talked about this before, but how the other states spit the bit when it comes to supporting this.
So I'm not sure. You got to remember, this came from Thomas Jefferson, and Kentucky was a state that was broken off of, it was the territory of Kentucky or of Virginia. So in other words, this was kind of like the kin folk to Jefferson and Madison. And so many of those men knew Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson didn't ride into the Kentucky Capitol. He wrote this letter and in confidence. So this is the big thing. Nobody knew that this letter was from Thomas Jefferson except the writer that took it. And I think he asked for complete confidence. And I believe that when it was given to the state legislature, it was given that this is from a very prominent member of the state of Virginia, that name will be withheld. And so they looked and they realized the magnitude of this. Now, there was a gentleman in the Kentucky legislature. I don't know if it was completely unanimous, but it there was no bars. Or there was really very little debate over this because they received this. If I go back up to the date on this, when Thomas Jefferson wrote this, I want to say it was in October, the document itself. But this was passed by, it was the 28th or the 27th of October. So it had to get into a writer's hand, and it had to actually go all the way into Kentucky, which probably took a day or two to get there. And then they actually had to process it. They sat and read it, and then they, you know, ruminated or what have you over the weekend, came in November 10th, within a week of the time they received it, they passed this thing. Now, later go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. And then he does it in 1799, and then Madison leads Virginia to do the same thing.
So
what I'm puzzled is it was had so much momentum that the other, and why the other states wouldn't jump in on this.
That's a good question. The Federalists actually started taking control of the state houses as well as the federal government. And so what ends up happening in the 1800 election is many of the Federalists get removed in the states as well as in the federal government. So these Federalists that we call Federalists were not the Federalists of the constitutional ratification debates. The Federalists and the Anti-Federalists at that point in time were those who were seeking a limited and defined government, and there were only a few people within those ranks that we didn't realize were really big government people. And actually, Hamilton did play his hand during the Constitutional Convention, and you can kind of see what he did and how he started acting once the Constitution was ratified. And his nefarious behavior, really, when you look at all the timelines and everything else, it really exposes Hamilton. But I think most of the other people really were limited and defined government because the rest of their career, they kept on pushing back. But the cabal, the Anti-Federalists that were all interested in, you know, being at the seat of power and keeping the power to the states, they gravitated. And actually, many of the Anti-Federalists went into the Senate and went into the House of Legislature, which is why when Madison shows up and he says, I want to create a Bill of Rights the very first year, everybody in the House of Representatives says, hey, well, you know, hold on here, cool your jets. Let's kick the tire on this baby. Let's take it for a trip. And Madison's going, are you kidding me? There was everybody was asking for this. The states really want to do this. So you could kind of see how all of a sudden, now that they got this shiny new government that had limited powers, those people who gravitated to it had this avarice of growing its powers, which is why Congress basically supported when Madison wasn't holding them back with the whip, you know, regarding the Assumption Act. It took, because to be clear, I covered the Assumption Act on my show. But when we look at the Assumption Act, Hamilton was completely beat. And this was a point in time when that creature probably would have actually may have surrendered, or at least he would have suffered a loss that would have changed the course of history. And I say that because he was so defeated, he went to Jefferson and appealed for Jefferson's support to get Madison to stop being so vigorously opposed to the Assumption Act. And so they had this dinner, and when you look at what happened and transpired in that dinner, it was basically Jefferson pressuring Madison to say, hey, we want to have the seat of government right here in D.C., and plus, if we don't let this Assumption Act, those northern states may actually step away from the Union because they're not going to be able to pay. Now, what was really happening was real conversations, but bottom line, those northern states still would have been accountable for their debt to the Union. And the fact that if they would have seceded, it would have forced probably a civil war. Because now they're saying, oh, we don't want to be a part of this Union because we can't pay our debt. because at that point in time, they needed to pay the debt. So Hamilton came up with this idea of creating the Assumption Act, where he basically created leverage that gave states money, where the Virginia states, you know, they gave them money and then they had to pay some of that money back. So in other words, it created this pump of a vigorous, you know, breath of put wind in the sail of this ship of the United States in the states that paid their debt, and those other states that needed to pay their debt, it gave them a reprieve. And so the Assumption Act was, you know, a pretty nefarious act, but it was kind of interesting how Madison had that control. When he backed off, all of a sudden, what was happening in Congress became a little bit harder for Madison to oppose, which is why during this time period, by the late 1790s, Madison was no longer serving as a congressman, nor was he serving in the government. And so when Thomas Jefferson was the vice president, he wrote this letter. So he was actually sitting in D.C. when he wrote this, or he was close by. And so that writer had to go from D.C. all the way to the Kentucky Capitol, which was a good haul. So, again, it took a couple of days to do this. And then Madison was prepared to actually ride down to Richmond to the Virginia legislature. When they received this letter in October, he kind of accompanied it, and he basically sat in Richmond for a while helping Richmond respond to this. And that's what the next resolution is going to be. Does that help?
It does. I'm still incredulous that they infiltrated the state legislatures, who anybody reading this would be able to see that if you don't resist this, the government, the federal government's just going to devour the states. I don't want to go down a rabbit hole.
No, but if you look at the Constitutional Convention, why did those men in the convention say, hey, we can't send this to the state legislature to ratify? Because those people will not give up the power. We knew Virginia, or they knew that Virginia, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, the big powerful states that were, you know, dominating in commerce amongst the Union and enjoying their control in these cabals. The states that vigorously debated were not going to rubber stamp this. And as a matter of fact, they wanted to do everything they could to kill the Constitution, the Anti-Federalists. And that's who you actually saw were the Anti-Federalists in the ratification debates. So they knew the problems that existed, but they didn't have any barriers of these people serving, other than the fact that they were constrained to only these delegated roles, responsibilities, powers, and so forth. And so, yeah, I'm just saying that it was pretty well apparent that they already knew that there were players that were, you know, consumed by avarice, that were willing to compromise and do things that they shouldn't have done, that they didn't have the authority to do, and so forth. So, anyway, they knew this going in, or actually coming out of the Constitution, which is why they called for a ratification of the people, or I should say representatives of the people. Actually, when you look at this, this gives us a good look at common law, because common law basically moves everything to ultimately in a Republican form of government, moves it to the representatives of the people to do their bidding. And so when they get elected to go off to basically ratify a constitution or an amendment, then those people kind of say, we don't want you to pass this. We want you to pass this or what have you. So that way they can efficiently deal with this new constitution. Going into the state legislature is a small power base that already has predisposed opinions. And so, but common law brings it closer to the people, to where the people have the ability to affect it, not through a democracy, but through representation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
And so that's why in our petitions, we're calling for a representative committee of the county to be formed. so that the people can declare that the annotated Constitution, this living Constitution that the federal government is doing, is unconstitutional, so that it ties the hands of the county commissioners, because the it's like a trial by jury. The most sacred thing is the voice of the people. And when you look at a trial by jury, it is a representation of the people in the vicinage or the, you know, the area. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why the trial by jury had to be preserved, because they knew that the people would not inflict tyranny upon themselves. They would recognize the threat of the laws as it being inflicted upon people. So the people would have the ability in a jury to nullify, you know, the outcome of a criminal trial or what have you.
Right.
Right. So anyway, so it was brilliant. And the system that they had, we still have the same system. We're just not exercising it because we've not been taught these fundamental principles of common law, and especially as it applies to this constitutional republic. But go ahead.
We have 5 minutes left. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
Stay in this rabbit hole. So if I were to synthesize what I think I heard you just say, politics won out over the law of constitutional law. Is that a fair statement?
So in this particular case, with the with these resolutions, politics of the time did. But what I see is the divine hand of providence kept America on the tracks. And so when we look at the Articles of Confederation, that was not done with the hand of the divine hand of providence. Does that make sense? Because Articles of Confederation was done while we were in a revolution. It was haphazardly done, and they already recognized problems, and it was so problematic that they said, we need to create a constitutional convention. Now that they had tranquility, they had the ability to actually seek the Lord, and they had the, because back in those days, they were running and dodging and hiding because, you know, there were points in time where Continental Congress had no idea if the British were coming. So they didn't have that ability. Where in the Constitution, they received the inspiration to create this document, as well as how to ratify it in dealing with the evil players, those people who wouldn't allow this to happen. And then as things started going awry, these men were inspired to take these actions and motions. And what these documents did was it proved that the state houses needed to be purged. It proved that the federal house needed to be purged. And these men, in less than a year's time, because we will look at the Kentucky Resolution of 1799 that was sent out in December. The election for the president was in the fall of 1800. So it was less than a year where Thomas Jefferson focused on a campaign to run for president. Madison sent out his response to the Virginia resolutions in January of 1800, because it took that long for all of the states to send back their resolves. And it was so, like I said, these guys were flabbergasted. And so they just went out on a campaign to overthrow the Federalists in power. So they used the Republican Party to do this. And so in closing out, when we watch what happened with the Republican Party, they basically made the Federalist Party extinct by 1820. When James Monroe was being reelected as president, he was actually unopposed in 1820 by, you know, the Electoral College. So one, I think it was the delegate from New Hampshire, threw out his vote. He said, I'm not casting a vote because he does not deserve the same privilege that George Washington received of being a unanimously voted for president. So he got all of the votes but one. So in other words, that coup was very effective in changing the politics of America.
Right.
Okay, so You know, we can't marginalize, you know, because we look at what these men were doing and the evil and all these things. But I think it helps us lose sight of the divine hand of providence and his interest in helping this nation actually settle. And what they ended up settling on through the years of 1800 to 1820, they finally brought peace to America by the War of 1812. Now, many people think that the compromises and so forth were in the Ghent, you know, the Treaty of Ghent, but that really didn't happen. The only real compromises that sent us backwards were after the Civil War and so forth. But anyway, the point is that, you know, if we really look, this nation was kept and propped up by his hand. So.
No, I agree. It's just, we've talked about this before. It's startling that things went sideways so quickly.
Yes. Right. And so in the next Wednesday, if I can get back to this, cause it's time to go, in the next Wednesday, we'll start off with Resolution 8 and we'll kind of do a quick summary of what we've already covered and then go back to this. And so what I'm going to do is I will put these things on a national, you know, this national call page. I will either put that on Mobistrip Press or I will put it up on Reclaiming the Republic. I'll talk to Woody after we do this to figure out, you know, whether we want to put this on a page that might, because I only want to share it with those who've gone through this. It's not that I don't want to share this with others. You can feel free to do that. It's just that I just want to make sure that people don't marginalize and just kind of listen or just kind of skim through. I think reading the documents is essential. It's just like reading the scriptures. You got to hear what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane, and you got to read it and see it for yourself so that you understand the power of the atonement and what really happened.
Just, I agree. Just a word of encouragement to those who may feel overwhelmed or intimidated by the documents. I felt that way myself and have shied away from it. But the more I read them, the easier it becomes to understand what these men said.
You know what?
A little bit on the Elizabethan style of, and they're obviously classically trained in terms of oratory and what have you. They were brilliant men, and it sometimes it can be difficult, but yet to carry on with what GR said, let's try and do this. Because it'll help, I do believe it'll help, as we try and recruit more people into it to see, you know, where this all began from in terms of getting away from the Constitution and how these two great leaders tried to bring it back. Before we wrap up,